Welcome to the world of superhumans, where a casual sprint covers 100 metres in just 9.5 seconds, and a little splash in the pool can take us 400 metres more in just 4 minutes. Yes, the Olympics are upon us, so we're browsing the sports pages today on The Stack. Broadcasting from Midori House in London, you're tuned to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Coming up...
And last year, when I covered Wimbledon, most of the journalists were not actually watching the matches in the court. They were sitting in the press room.
Sport is all about the action of the moment. So how do you capture that excitement on the printed page? We'll ask one man who knows better than most. Also ahead...
One of the impulses behind this issue was to try and... look at the Western from a different angle, and maybe a more fun angle, like, you know, show how modern they can be.
We'll take some time out with the editor of Little White Lies as he guides us through the latest issue of the world's most beautiful movie magazine. All that ahead on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack, coming to you from Midori House here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. My guest today is one of the most respected voices in the world of sports journalism, the author of 27 books, I think that's right, 28. He's written one even before I wrote this cue. A regular sight at all manner of sporting events. It's Mihir Bose. Mihir, welcome to The Stack. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, a prolific writer, someone who knows the industry of sports journalism inside out. It's interesting, the Olympics ongoing at the moment. Let's do a bit of a temperature take of the coverage of the games. Obviously, most people now view it through a prism of TV, don't they, digital. How's the print coverage of the Olympics faring? Is it as robust, is it as strong as ever in your view?
In some ways, it's increased because some of the papers, my old paper, The Telegraph, has an Olympic supplement. It's not all the papers, but some of them do. And many of the other papers have really even put football to one side and allowed the Olympics, which is a very big thing to do. And I think this is the effect of the London Olympics. Mm. Because before that, and this is interesting, I was at The Telegraph for 12 years under a sports editor for most of the time called David Welch, who was very, very keen on the Olympics. But most other sports editors were not. And we used to send big teams and so on. But this is the big sort of, if you like, the London 2012 legacy. Nobody talked of that legacy, but this is one of the legacies. Yes, you mentioned television. You can follow the action on my, you know, I can follow it on my phone sometimes on things like that. But nevertheless, the print media, I think, is keeping abreast because it can do stories which, to a certain extent, television can't. The early part of the week when Britain, Team GB, hadn't won many medals, there was a lot of comment, is this the worst team ever? And then that's the moment they started winning medals.
And tell me a bit about the stories, I mean, the editorial process, because it is interesting. You read the papers the next day, you know, everyone has a backstory, and it's a truism, isn't it, of sport, that people love a rags to riches or a rise again and all this kind of thing. Is that still the staple? Is that the meat and drink? Or do you think that sometimes the sheer endeavour, faster, higher, stronger, sometimes is allowed to just speak for itself?
Well, to a certain extent, because for the British press, because of the time difference, they have to do more backstories to a certain extent. So they have to write, is Michael Phelps the greatest ever Olympian, because he wins so many medals. Because it's not easy to keep up, because by the time the papers appear, and given the time difference, the swimming is early on.
Mr. Phelps, he wins gold medals like you write books, Mihir. There's well, a blink and you miss it, another one bites the dust. But it is interesting, isn't it? And Phelps is a good example, because you get always these great stories. Yeah. You know, here's a scale replica of how giant Michael Phelps's feet are and all this kind of thing. Do you think it brings out the best in sports journalists when you have an event like the Olympics to zero in on?
Yes, it does. Well, this Olympics, of course, has been, the preamble to it has been pretty nasty, pretty awful with the Russian drugs and so on, which is, if you like, brought the Olympics onto the news pages. But this is a great occasion for the sports writers to come back and say, well, all that was, noises off stage, and this is the real thing. So it does, and also it allows sports writers to do what they want to do, which is write the big sort of pieces. What does it mean? What did the opening ceremony mean for sport and for mankind? You know, it allows you to become, I wouldn't say bombastic, but you know, they but tell no, us great truths.
A bit of bombast doesn't do anyone any harm here.
Great truths about life.
And on that point, it's interesting that that strikes me as interesting, particularly you said, you know, it's a chance for the sports writers to maybe escape from the news pages. But can you be a sports writer now and not understand how to sell and write your story as a news story? Can you indeed divorce the news agenda from the sporting agenda, whether it's the political situation in Brazil or the insanity in the IOC or in FIFA or whatever it is? Is there still a truly sporting writerly discipline anymore, or do you necessarily have to become a master of more trades?
Well, to a certain extent, partly because what has happened to the print media, many of my colleagues in the press now have to even take pictures with their iPhone, not selfies, you know.
Heaven help us.
But I tell you what has happened, but the, if you like, the old-fashioned sports writers, and there are quite a few of them, do actually resent, if you like, the intrusion of the cheats and the awfulness. They do feel, you know, this is not what we're here for. We're here to write about Usain Bolt, not whether, you know, a Russian athlete or whoever has taken drugs. They write about it, but there's a feeling this shouldn't what we should be writing about. And they say this isn't sport. Without, in my opinion, you know, that is as much part of sport as anything else.
I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, the Olympics is front and centre in everyone's minds at the moment for these, what, 2-3 weeks or so. Is there another sporting event, though, something that is, for you personally, something that, you know, it transcends those concerns? Even you take off your journalist hat and you just think you have that kind of, it's a childlike excitement. Is it the first day of the new football season? Is it the Tour de France? Is it, you know, a test match in a particular venue? Is there one singular thing for you that just fills you with a boyish, the Mihir Bose of, I don't know, a couple of decades ago.
What might it be? I think there would be two things. First of all, the start, particularly for a test match at Lord's. If it is the first test match, particularly of the series, but even if it's a test match at Lord's, where you want to go there before they've tossed the coin, because at that moment anything is possible. The two teams, one team may be very bad, but in your mind you can still think, yes, maybe the worst team in the world could defeat the best, and the first day of the football season does matter. Mm. You know, for your sins, you are a follower of a team. I'm a follower of Tottenham Hotspur, who haven't won the.
You and me both, man.
Who haven't, you know, they say next year in Jerusalem. So you sort of get up and say, is this our year in Jerusalem? And how far is Jerusalem? I mean, I don't know how many miles it is. But nevertheless, you know, it's that sort of belief. You really, though, of course, you report, when you report something, you try and be as objective as possible. But a little bit in you, because that's the magic of sport. I mean, who would have thought about Leicester? You know, that's the magic of sport, that almost anything is possible.
Now, Mihir, we're going to talk about a few specific titles, actually, a little bit later in the programme. But just going back, when you were kind of a tyro journalist, or even earlier, and you were following sport, were there writers who, for you, captured that romance that you describe? Or did you just sort of... Yeah, but I imagine your appetite for sports and sports coverage was so voracious that you would literally read everything you could get your hands on. Were there people, was it going back to the, I don't know, some of the great, you know, writers on boxing in the US, in the, whatever it might be, say 50s or 60s? What stirred your passions in, on the printed page back then?
I mean, people like Brian Glanville, who I worked with and who still writes, and a wonderful writer, Hugh McIlvany, you know, still about around, John Arlott, great commentator, Neville Carders. Oh yes, I think that Alan Ross. There were lots of people you read and thought, I want to write like them, you know, and you read that, and you actually learned reading, you know. You suddenly said, my God, can you actually use that word, you know? I mean, is that the way to describe something? Oh, yes. I mean, you wanted to read. Geoffrey Green, I remember, who was a football correspondent of the Times, you saw the match on television, and the next morning, you wanted to read him to see what did he say. You know, you saw the match, and you had your impressions, but you wanted his view of how he saw the match, and that actually gave you a fresh perspective, a fresh way of looking at the game, and you know, that was immensely educative.
Do you think, though, that the journalists now who are sort of, you know, cutting their teeth, or, you know, or who are students in journalism school who are thinking of doing this, is their job harder because we've already talked about the digital incursion? You know, now football writers, their match copies on practically like as the final whistle sounds. Does that diminish their potential impact, or do you think if someone writes with great clarity, with passion, with creativity, can it still be as impactful?
Well, Can I say that even when I was reporting football, you had to report at the whistle and so on, but you didn't have to report every minute. Now what is happening, you have the minute-by-minute reporting, which is an entirely different thing. And last year, when I covered Wimbledon, it was quite sobering for me to find that most of the journalists were not actually watching the matches in the court. They were sitting in the press room watching it on television, because every minute they had to tap something out. And to me, that's not what I went into sport for. You want to be there because you want, you know, being in a stadium, being in the theater of dreams, if you like, whatever the theater of dreams is wonderful, and you want to report the match. You don't want to see it on television and just tap out, you know, Murray has played a backhand shot or something like that. I think there's too much of that because of the fear of what is happening on social media and so on. So all the newspapers think, oh yes, they must have their correspondent give you a minute-by-minute account, and I'm not sure it actually does anything to their sales.
And one questions how much as a value it really adds to the consumer. Yeah. Mihir Bose, great to speak with you. We'll talk more about some selections that you've brought in a little bit later in the programme. This is The Stack. We'll continue saluting the sports pages with Mihir soon, but for now, let's take a break from all that physical exertion and focus on something entirely different. The latest issue of Little White Lies will be hitting a newsstand near you shortly with a decidedly dusty Western theme. Monocle's Ben Ryland, host of The Cinema Show, sat down with the editor of the world's most beautiful movie magazine, David Jenkins.
I like to read movie magazines, and I've never picked up one that is prettier than this one. This one is obviously quite, this issue is quite dusty, quite gritty, which fits in with The Magnificent Seven. And I really love how this, the theme for the movie has taken over almost really the entire issue. When you're flicking through, you're really taken into this other world, aren't you? Mm-hmm. What were some of the elements that were sitting on the mood board when you put this one together?
Well, I guess I've got to try and second guess our creative director, Timber Smits, when it comes to questions of the design of the magazine. Essentially, you know, we have a kind of initial discussion about the film and why we've chosen it and what kind of route we want to take. And I guess he then develops further about what, you know, what the design route is going to be. I mean, the cover, for instance, is, I mean, he is a kind of, he's a monster for texture. I mean, he loves these kind of distressed kind of motifs in
images. Looks like it's been the image of Denzel Washington on the front cover with the number 7 wrapped around his head. It almost looks like it's been printed on some sort of piece of iron that's then been buried under a dirt road for maybe 50 or 60 years.
Well, that's the effect he goes for. He is a texture nerd. He swaps textures with his friends. I mean, it's quite, I've seen him do it. It's quite insane.
That's amazing. I love how you open the cover here, and the first thing you see is a selection of plastic cowboys, an assortment of little plastic cowboy toys in here. So, I mean, that sort of draws you into this make-believe world, doesn't it? We're not taking you into the real Old West. We're taking you into that specific sort of Old West seen in the old movies, Stagecoach, My Darling Clementine, those sorts of films. When you were putting this together then, were they the sorts of films you would go back to? Even though we're talking about a new film that is yet to be released, of course, the cues really come from what we know about the Western.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we picked this film as a kind of excuse to explore further and to re-look at the Western, I guess. I mean, to modern audiences, the Western does have a slight sort of fusty old generation feel from another era. Maybe I think modern audiences find them a bit of a certain type of movie that is maybe they wouldn't tend to approach on a regular basis. And I guess one of the impulses behind this issue was to try and look at the Western from a different angle, maybe a more fun angle. Try and make it seem like, you know, show how modern they can be. For me, I'm just a massive, massive Western geek, and you know, I wanted an excuse to talk about them and to and to write about them, really. And
well, you've got yourself a pretty good excuse here. So when you were putting this together, then obviously we've got The Magnificent Seven, the remake, which is coming out, starring Denzel Washington. But that's obviously not the only film we're talking about in the issue. What were some of the other topics that you picked up on when trying to create this issue that takes us inside that genre?
Well, I guess one of the things that I wanted to do to almost limit the purview a little bit, because I think, you know, but by just diving headlong into the Western would take, you know, it's a book length thing. It's a book of many volume length thing. So it was trying to find a kind of a limitation, something that we could, you know, get our lasso around, I guess.
When you've got a special issue of the magazine like this one, though, it sort of feels like when films would often have, I mean, it still happens every now and then, a film will have a tie-in book that will come out with the film that mm-hmm. will sort of take you beyond the film itself and mm-hmm. into the backstory of it and explore all of these different angles. I guess that's, in a way, what each issue of Little White Lies does. And often it's not about a particular film, though. It can be about a particular genre or an aesthetic seen in the cinema. It's sort of an extension on that sort of concept, isn't it?
I think, we do look at the actual film and, you know, the story of the film itself that goes on the cover of the magazine. But I think the impulse also is to look beyond, look how the conversation can develop beyond that, how this film fits into the kind of tapestry of cinema, you know, what are the connections that could be made? You know, how can we go from this film, how can we join this film to another film? And you know, what's the story there? Who looking at the people, you know, not the people just involved in the film, but the people who inspired the people who are involved in the film, and you know, just trying to pick up on what are the essential things about this film? What is it about? And what is it saying? And how does that link to the wider world? I mean, you know, I think although everything that we do in the mag is kind of filtered through the world of film, the conversations we want to have are filtered through movie people and movies. I think we're trying to be aware of that. It's not just, you know, that there is a world beyond that as well. That the movies are kind of a conduit to real tangible things. And I guess in some way we're trying to make that connection. If whether we succeed or not, I don't know. But I mean, I guess I guess it's not something that we're trying to force into the reader's face. I mean, I think we're just offering our thoughts on things and hoping that those connections, you know, we I guess it's a kind of gateway. I guess I want people to read the mag and then go on and explore further.
Thanks to David Jenkins. In conversation there with Ben Ryland. For more on the world of movies as seen through the Monocle lens, download The Cinema Show now from our website. This is The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Mihir Bose, my special guest this week, is still with me. Mihir, you've brought in a couple of titles. And there's a couple, actually, that you wanted to mention as well, which we can talk about. But you've got World Soccer. Now, obviously, we're an international station, so there may be some of our listeners somewhere who are not overly familiar. But in a way, it's the kind of the global football fans' Bible, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, World Soccer is a very, very good publication. Though it's a British publication, it has a very international perspective. Mm. The magazine I've got here is the one covering the Euros and how Portugal won and so on. And okay, we've seen the matches, we've read them, but to actually bring it back in, if you like, a quick book form, the great goals, the awful mistakes, things like that, you know, it's a very, very good read. And I've been reading it for years. There was a time when I used to keep copies, but my wife objected. So I've had to throw out.
This is a recurrent theme on The Stack. Magazine aficionados whose partners tend to run out of space.
You know, it was a choice, you know, between her and the magazine. So I'm afraid,
with it for a while.
Yeah, but much as I love this, you know, I know I love my wife more. So anyway, but I think that's a very, very good publication. The other one I haven't got here, which whether one calls it a magazine or not, is of course the one to mention is L'Équipe, which is the daily sports paper. I mean,
well, there's a funny story about this actually, Mihir, because we knew you were going to mention that, and so my colleague Fernando very, very sort of diligently went to get a copy. He couldn't get a copy. It's sold out from all the newsagents, which is interesting. I mean, that very much tells a story about, I mean, its enduring appeal. And people might say, hang on, a daily print sport, this is going to be defunct before you can say, but no, it has a really enduring appeal.
It has, and of course, from our British perspective here, because our British papers have a lot of coverage on sport, no daily sports paper has really taken off. There have been attempts. But L'Équipe, one must say, does a great job. Mm-hmm. And it covers, okay, it has a football focus, if you like. I don't think L'Équipe gives a lot of coverage to cricket. I don't think the Test match, England-Pakistan, they have Ian Botham saying, you know, why the swing bowling isn't working. But nevertheless, I think that's a paper worth. But you see, one of the things that we ought to mention is that actually, you know, for instance, a rounded world magazine of sport is very difficult. The only ones who've done it consistently have been the Americans with Sports Illustrated.
And why do you think that is? Because there's such great writing. You were reeled off a few UK names as well a little bit earlier who cover and have covered sport indeed for decades with such incredible eloquence and colour and charisma. And you find that wherever in the world you go, whether it's sports dailies or weeklies, people are so passionate. One would have thought sports often talked about as this great unifying force, and yet that's true. It is only the Americans. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I think perhaps in sport we follow sports generally, but apart from the Olympics, we don't follow sports. The sports fans don't follow all the sports all the time. But many British fans will follow football and their teams, and for our sins, Tottenham Hotspur. But you know, they will not follow everything that's happening in gymnastics or Catherine Granger wins silver and she comes up at the time of the Olympics, but do we follow rowing or you just don't? I think what happens with sport is while there's a general love of sport, the actual focus of your attention is a particular sport and you follow that, and therefore a magazine dedicated to that does all right. But in this country, for instance, international or world sports magazines covering all sports have never really worked. But in America, Sports Illustrated has worked. And the reason for that, I believe, is because America is such a federal country where newspapers, you know, in Britain, we're talking from London, you know, we have 11 daily newspapers coming out from the capital city. Whereas in America, I think perhaps the Wall Street Journal is the international, you know, the national daily. And I don't think the Wall Street Journal has too much. I mean, it might have the odd for sports business article,
sport feature,
but it's not having, you know. So I think that may be the reason why sport. And of course, I think they always have an annual swimsuit feature, don't they?
That still sells very well. Who could possibly say why? And just to delve back in then, Mihir, to your magazines, I think so. You had World Soccer. You got a slightly more, I don't know what you call it, an esoteric cricketing title. Tell us about, and maybe describe the magazine, the physical appearance of this one.
It actually has a sort of small book form, you know. It's like, and it's called Night Watchman, and it's a publication that hasn't been going very long, but it's a cricket publication. Again, cricket publications haven't been doing all that well. I mean, Wisden sells and things like that.
Which is a true Bible of the sport.
True Bible, and of course, it's amazing. It actually is a record of matches that have taken place a year ago, and people are still buying it, despite the fact that, you know, if you like, that's history. But this is an interesting compendium. It comes out every quarter. And what it does, it gives you a feel of articles which would not get into the daily papers. You know, it might be about a journalist. It might be about something that happened. There's an article here about, say, for instance, that the domestic cricket in India is declining, though IPL is hugely successful. But the four-day match, nobody comes. There's a nice description here of a match which was the final of the domestic competition, four-day competition. 125 people watched it, you see, of whom quite a few were probably relatives of the players.
Well, exactly. You got 22 times
in a stadium of 30,000. I mean, that sort of thing, which is where I think magazines of this kind do well. They bring out something which, in a way, the daily newspapers won't have time, or, you know, the general coverage won't have time to do that.
And it's interesting, because of the look of it, and Night Watchman, we should say, is a sort of an esoteric cricketing phrase. Again, certain of our international listeners will be very familiar with that. Others maybe, well, they can get on Google and have a look. But it's interesting in terms of the appearance of the magazine, because it is a bit more like a small independent title. Yeah. It's sort of perfect bound, it's smaller, lots of white space. And as you said, it's got a bookish quality
almost.
It has
a bookish quality.
And it's very different from, say, World Soccer, which is unashamedly kind of glossy, shouty, read-me thing.
Where you know, it has Neymar on this issue, has Neymar. Mm. So, you know, people who follow football would know who Neymar is. Whereas here, there is actually no, if you're quite right, there is no picture of any cricketer. It's actually as if to say, well, if you want to be different, why don't you pick this up?
It's broadcasting its thoughtfulness.
Yeah, that's right. Yes,
So, let me tell you, in terms of, you know, how you consume your sporting media, you know, do you still wander up to, I don't know, a favoured newsstand somewhere about the place and have a browse and look at something, whether it's a glossy magazine or something like Night Watchman, a new title, and just, you know, let your eyes wander and pick something maybe new you've not seen before? Or do you tend to kind of go back to your staple reads, whether it's the Sports Illustrated, whether it's the broadsheets? How does your sports media consumption model work? And has it changed a lot in the last few years?
Well, to a certain extent now, you tend to go onto the internet, you know, and see what is... Yes, you do go into the newsstand, but one's newsstand visits are rarer these days. But I still like going to the newsstand and seeing what the magazines are. And, you know, and then you see a magazine on golf or rugby or something like that. And particularly if that sport, if the Rugby World Cup is going on, you want to see how they're treating it. That's the moment when you do. Yes, you do browse, and then you sometimes pick up and say, "Oh, well, this is interesting. I never heard of it before. You know, let's have a look at it."
And what about the work that people are doing? I mean, we already touched upon this by talking about, you know, the constraints and the demands on people's time as much as anything else, in terms of how they're expected to cover the games that we play and that we watch. Are you reassured? I mean, you probably get deluged with requests from people who want to pick your brain about how to sort of fashion a successful career in the discipline. But are you reassured that we'll still see not just great writers or great photographers, but great editors as well? Because one sometimes worries that that's a discipline that's maybe losing some of its luster, simply because, you know, it's the idea of citizen journalist. You know, everyone's an editor now. Does that worry you?
Well, what worries me is that, I think too many young journalists, in order to break into the profession, are being asked to do very low-paid jobs. I mean, I've heard stories about interns, particularly on online things, hardly being paid anything, you know, virtually paying paying the organization to do that. And secondly, I think the subbing thing, you know, which is the organizing thing, I think that is being, if you like, downgraded. It's as if, you know, I think when I first joined the Sunday Times, which was a long time ago, there were not that many pages, and the sports editor was a more creative person. He had to work out. Now, I think, to a certain extent, you know, it seems simpler. Well, Barcelona are playing Real Madrid, so obviously, you know, we'll have a 1,000-word report. I mean, in those days, even Brian Glanville didn't get more than 500 words to write, though he would have wanted to write a lot more. So, in a sense, when space was limited, you had to be a bit more inventive in how you covered it. Now, most papers have supplements and so on. And in a sense, I think, you're filling space rather than thinking of how to make it interesting for the reader.
Mihir, just a final thought then. We've mentioned some great titles and we've mentioned some of the challenges. We've mentioned some of your own memories and experiences. What's the next key development, do you think, as we look a little further ahead into the medium term? You know, are we just still wrestling with this idea of how, say, traditional print deals with, you know, the challenge of digital, that old discussion? Or do you think, is there another, you know, a generational shift that could be round the corner? Or do you think it's still that battle, really, that's going to define the next, I don't know, 5-10 years of how sports is covered in the printed media?
I think to that extent the battle is still going on, though print media has had to take second place. But what I think we will try and see more developments from the print media side to at least keep hold of that corner, if you like, corner of the sporting field. I mean, they were once the most dominant factor. Now they're just a corner. And how do they keep hold of it? And also, how do they make sure that the younger audience coming in? I think what we might well see is attempts by people to, for instance, introduce various variations on how you watch sport on your telephone or iPad or what have you. You know, how do you do that? And I think we can see more developments along that score. The use of technology and maybe, you know, freelance attempts by people to do things and things like that. I think we'll see more of that.
Wonderful stuff. Mihir, it's so great to hear your insights, as always. Thanks very much for being with us on The Stack. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to Mihir Bose and David Jenkins. Thanks too to today's programme producer Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Comments or queries are welcome as always, info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us the same time next Saturday. You can always listen again if you're worried that you'll miss us before then, at monocle.com via iTunes or your preferred platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.